Thank you, Vajradevi. Sisters in the Dharma, can you hear me at the back?
Good.
So in line with my categorization last night as a baby boomer, many years ago when I was a post-hippie young Buddhist, there was a theatre company called the Red Buddha Theatre, which some of you may have seen or remember, many of you not. I can't remember much about what they did, actually, except I think it was very avant-garde and involved, on one occasion, a dead fish. But I presume that because we think of Amitabha, the Red Buddha, as the Buddha of the West, that it seemed an appropriate title, the Red Buddha Theatre, for a Western theatre company. So Amitabha, as we know from the mandala of the five Buddhas, is the Buddha of the Western direction. He's the Red Buddha of infinite light, and in his manifestation as Amitayus, he's the Buddha of infinite life. He's often said also to be, because he's red, the Buddha of love and compassion. He's also the Buddha of meditation, because in his traditional form, his hands are folded in his lap in the mudra of dhyana or meditation. And in those folded hands, he holds his emblem, the red lotus. So the red lotus symbolizes spiritual unfoldment, spiritual rebirth, spiritual growth. So each of the five Buddhas has a particular prajna, and you could say each of the five Buddhas has an eye of wisdom, a different eye of wisdom, but they see reality from a slightly different point of view. So Akshobhya looks into the mirror and sees all phenomena reflected in that mirror. So he sees with a clarity and objectivity. He sees the difference between objects and beings. Ratnasambhava sees with the eye of beauty and appreciation and sees things in their essential sameness or essential oneness. Amitabha sees from the standpoint of a deep inner vision, the discriminating vision, and sees both difference and unity, difference and sameness at the same time. Amoghasiddhi sees with the eye of all-accomplishing wisdom, seeing unfettered activity beyond karma, and Virochana sees with the eye of panoramic awareness. So Amitabha's eye is the eye of inner reflective vision, born of meditation. His wisdom is the discriminating wisdom, or the distinguishing wisdom, which sees, as I've said, things in both their uniqueness and their particularity. So this wisdom, although it's described as distinguishing or discriminating, is not intellectual knowledge in any sense. It's a clear intuitive vision. It's beyond concepts. It's purely spontaneous. And both sense perception and intellectual discrimination are converted into a transcendental faculty of inner vision through the practice of meditation. So this light of intuitive, clear vision arises out of that red, fully open lotus of unfolding creative meditation. So Amitabha's wisdom transforms both sense perception, the skanda that he transforms, and the poison of craving. So craving involves our awareness, our energy, our attention, in spreading out over the surface of existence, seeking ever new experience. Very restless energy, appropriating, seeking sense satisfaction. So the traditional image of the hindrance of craving is of water stained with coloured dye. And in a way that's attractive, but it's really rather superficial. So the water has a certain beauty, but the purity of the water, and by analogy the mind, has been lost. And in The Path of the Inner Life, in the essay of the same name by Bhante, he talks about the inner life being characterized by becoming, and I quote, indifferent to objects of perception, so arising out of renunciation. And he says, if the aspirant can resist the solicitations of the objects of perception and turn his senses, as it were, inside out, like the five fingers of a glove, thus reversing their direction, they will merge into a single inner sense, and with this subtle inner sense, he will be able to perceive spiritual realities. So, very interesting image that our energy goes out to our five senses like the five fingers of a glove over all these objects that we crave. And we need to turn that around, turn the glove inside out and focus the fingers within our heart, I suppose, so that we have a single inner sense with which we'll be able to perceive inner spiritual realities. So we withdraw the scattered forces of our mind into this single unified force of attention. So eventually this purely spiritual perception of purely spiritual realities by this inner spiritual sense will take place beyond the subject-object relation altogether. So this seems to me, this piece from the Path of the Inner Life, seems to me to express what's being symbolised by Amitabha. So we withdraw our energy from sense perception and craving, by which the mind is scattered over a multiplicity of objects and our energy is therefore weakened, and we focus and concentrate that energy within through the practice of meditation until the mind becomes so concentrated that it gives birth to wisdom. So having explored some of Amitabha's symbolism, I'm wondering whether the fact that he is the Buddha of the Western direction in the mandala has any special significance for us. Is he a special Buddha for us in the West because he's the Buddha of the Western direction? We know that Amitabha became a very central focus in Far Eastern Buddhism, in the Pure Land school, so obviously he's not just, as it were, a Buddha for the West. And I'm sure if we look deeply into the symbolism of any of the five Buddhas, we could see their significance for us here and now. But I think it's interesting to think about what characterises the modern Western world and how that does relate to the symbolism of Amitabha. So the Western world seems to be characterised by craving, by sense desire, materialism and rampant consumerism. So greed and craving have always been and always will be part of samsaric existence. But in the West we seem to have made a speciality of it. So I don't know if you remember that 80s film Wall Street, where the main character, played by Michael Douglas, I think, called Gordon Gekko, gave a speech, "Greed is good." A very famous speech in a movie in the 80s. So our culture seems to be based on consuming, owning, acquiring, having more and more, and it's got to be ever new, isn't it? It can be upgraded and newer and better, and what, do your washing whiter and whiter, and so on and so forth. And that seems to be in every field of modern life. So whether it's in the world of technology, that you need a faster modem and a greater speed on your computer, and whatever, you know, you've gone digital on your recording equipment. Everything's got to be upgraded all the time, newer and better. It's the same in the world of popular modern culture, the same in the world of fashion. There's always a new collection hitting the high street, shorter and showing more of your body, seems to be these days. And in popular culture, in films and pop music, and in food. I think that was mentioned last night, wasn't it? So one example that strikes me, I think, is in the world of films, because I really enjoy cinema. I've always enjoyed cinema and going to the movies. I don't go so often, I live in the country, but I'm interested in films. So if I've got the opportunity of seeing a film, I'll look in the paper and I'll read the crits and so on and so forth. But I am often aware of the sheer volume of films that are made every week and hit the cinemas every week. It can be an enormous number of films. It almost puts me off. It doesn't quite put me off, but it almost puts me off that amount of time, energy, enormous amounts of money go into that industry. And maybe they're on screen for a week, and then they're just on the shelf in a video shop, aren't they? Another area is food. I think that the kind of, we live in a multiple choice society, don't we? I think that reaches its apotheosis, as it were, in American supermarkets. Vast choice of food. And I remember going for breakfast in America, and I just asked for egg on toast. And my waitress, who said, "No, I'm whatever, I'm Lucy, I'm your waitress," gave me about 20 different ways I could have my eggs done, and 20 different kinds of bread and ways I could have my toast done. And it was early in the morning. I'm not that great in the morning. And I said, "I just want egg on toast." And she said, "Are you on a special diet or something?" I said, "No, I'm English." It was kind of overwhelming choice. And Well, we have the same. We have the same in this country. Yeah. Not to that degree, but we live in a multiple choice society where I think it was Vajradevi last night saying we can have what we want. It's there to have if we've got the means to get it, as it were. So I think we identify ourselves by what we have and own to some extent in this culture. So it's interesting that the realm in the Wheel of Life associated or transformed by Amitabha is, of course, the realm of the hungry ghosts, the realm of frustrated craving. I think that's a realm we see represented in the modern world because not everybody can get what they want all the time. So within the symbolism of Amitabha, the frustrated craving of the hungry ghost mentality is transformed, of course, into meditative contentment. So I think Amitabha is and can be a very potent symbol for us living in the modern Western world, calling us to collect our scattered energies and focus them within through the practice of meditation, calling us to withdraw from the Kamaloka, the world of sense desire, to go forth from that realm, to create focus and depth as opposed to scattered energy over multiplicity. And I wondered whether Bhante's vision of Amitabha, in which Amitabha is not so much the meditating Buddha, but Amitabha is holding up the red lotus in his red hand, in his right hand, is a more dynamic image for us than the purely meditating Amitabha, the way he's saying, you really must do this, you really must unfold the red lotus of your inner contemplation. So that image of Bhante's does call our attention to the red lotus of unfolding inner vision born of meditation. And in that inner vision, it's not that we lose particularity. The distinguishing inner vision, or the wisdom of Amitabha, is an unprejudiced awareness of objects in all forms of life, but against a background of oneness, of sameness, because we've moved around the mandala incorporating the previous wisdoms. So Amitabha also symbolises the transformation of the passion of craving into love and compassion born of meditation. So craving is a very strong energy, a very strong passion, as it were. And again, it's sort of out into objects out there, whether they're people or ideas or things. So I think, again, that symbolism can speak to us in the modern world because we do seem to be hung up on and obsessed by the passion of sex or the romantic myth. So again, we can transform those energies, our energy moving outwards in that direction, within, and transform that energy into love and compassion. So Amitabha is also, of course, associated with, or is the centre of the pure land of Sukhavati, the land which is full of bliss. So this is a place of no pain, no suffering, no bereavement, no separation, no loss of any kind, no old age, no sickness or death. It's a place of perfect peace without war, conflict, battle, or misunderstanding of any kind. It's a place where there's no distinction between male and female, so there's no kind of polarization, so hence there's no craving or covetousness. No one ever has to do any work, as food and clothing appear of their own accord. So in this pure land, all one has to do is sit on a lotus at the feet of the Buddha and listen to the Dharma. So all of this, of course, symbolises our own attempts to create a pure land, a world beyond the Kamaloka, beyond ultimately even the Rupa and Arupa Loka, and a world of ideal community with ideal conditions. So Amitabha's time of day is the time of the setting sun, and traditionally this is seen as a time of contemplation, a time of meditation. So the day's work is done, and your mind can be freed from mundane cares and turn within. In a way, again, in the modern West, it's not so simple because people work around the clock and things are open around the clock. But in a traditional society, as the sun goes down, this is what you would do. You would contemplate the sunset and enter a different state of mind. So it symbolises, again, the mind withdrawing from outer material objects and, again, focusing within and giving birth to a higher consciousness, a meditative consciousness beyond the outer senses. Again, characterised by the unfolding red lotus. And the element associated with Amitabha is, of course, the element of fire. So it's the upward leaping flame of inspiration and devotion, which is very characteristic of Amitabha. So if we imagine ourselves contemplating the setting sun and visualizing Amitabha glowing red with love and compassion for all beings, we could imagine ourselves on the lion terrace at Il Convento. For those of you who've been to Il Convento know that place. Perhaps it should be the peacock terrace, ideally. It's the wrong animal for Amitabha. But it's a terrace up on the first floor of Il Convento, leading off of a covered terrace. And the lion terrace is open. It faces west, and we call it the lion terrace because it has a stone lion sitting on the corner, looking out, gazing out at the setting sun, gazing out over the valleys and hills of Tuscany to the sea beyond. So a favourite pastime at Il Convento at the end of the day is to sit up on the lion terrace and just watch the sunset, to gaze at the setting sun. Other times of the day, it's to lie in the sun. And at night, it's to stand or sit or lie and gaze up at a clear, starry sky. So perhaps it's becoming obvious that I'm using the symbolism of the red Buddha of Amitabha, the Buddha of the Western direction, to lead us into, to provide a mythic context for the world of ordination and ordination retreats, past, present, and future. So when Bhante encouraged us, and particularly Sanghi Devi, a few years ago when he was visiting Tiruvathanloka, to have a longer ordination retreat for women, preferably not in the United Kingdom, he emphasised two things. I think we're familiar with these two things because we did have an order weekend on them a couple of years ago, two or three years ago. He thought that such a retreat, would give people a much stronger experience of the going forth dimension of going for refuge, and also the possibility of engaging in more ritual and a greater experience of the mythic and imaginal. He said he thought that such a retreat would have an effect on the women's wing of the order and the order as a whole, even if only a very small number of women could get away for a longer retreat. So Sangha Devi responded and set up us hiring Il Convento, which we've now used for 2 years and will use this year. And I think given that we needed to rent a place until we have our own place, I think we've been quite lucky to rent Il Convento because, of course, it has an association with the movement in the order, and that the men used it as an ordination retreat centre venue for several years, I think maybe 6-7 years. So we have that link with the place, and the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are still there. Say no more about that. Secret. So in going off on a longer ordination retreat at Il Convento, we're trying to create a pure land, at least for that length of time. We're trying to leave behind the world of the Kamaloka of sense desire, the modern Western world characterised by craving, and enter a more pure land. So we're also trying to go forth from the known in our lives into the unknown, and to just immerse ourselves in a simple life of meditation, silence and community. And within that world, to enter more deeply into the mythic, opening up to the imaginal realm of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So the ordination retreat at Il Convento is a very special time, devoted entirely to setting up conditions for our ordinands to prepare themselves for the biggest step they will ever take in their lives. That step being entering the order, having their effective going for refuge witnessed by a private preceptor, taking the 10 precepts within that context, having their connection with the imaginal witnessed in the form of a mantra, and having their new self witnessed in the sense of being given a new name, and then later publicly welcomed into the order by a public preceptor. So the ordination ceremonies, both private and public, lie at the heart of the retreats at Il Convento. The ordination ceremony is a pivotal turning point in our lives upon which rests the rest of our spiritual lives. All practice before that leads up to it, and our practice thereafter leads from it. So the retreat reflects that. There are two main phases of the retreat: preparation for the ordination ceremonies, and then initiation, as it were, into the myth of the order. So preparation for ordination, of course, has been going on a long time before one arrives at Il Convento, and in all the things that one does until one's invited on an ordination retreat. But the preparation is intensified at Il Convento. So first of all, we seal off the mandala of practice in some ritual way, and then we embark on preparation for ordination, firstly through exploring the 10 precepts, which are going to be taken in a ritual context of the ordination ceremony later, through reflection and confession. And my experience of having more time to do that on an ordination retreat is that people realise the significance of the 10 precepts much more deeply, even though they've studied them before. They seem to sort of really understand the significance of the 10 precepts as an expression of effective going for refuge. And then we embark on the phase of spiritual death, as described in Bhante's system of meditation. In a context of complete silence, we take up the six element practice. So the meditations and pujas and our rituals in the cloister, the silence and the contemplations of the sunset, dawns and night skies, as well as contemplating the blue sky of expanded consciousness, all that opens the way for a deeper connection with the imaginal, so that a Buddha or Bodhisattva can manifest in this space as our particular connection with that realm. So there are weeks of silence at your convento. The other thing that happens is in that time, each person builds up a relationship with their private preceptor, leading up to the private ordination ceremonies. And we have time after the private ordinations. We have a very creative bardo where people are semi-ordained, as it were. They've had their private ordination ceremony, but they've not yet emerged as a fully fledged order member, in which, again, we're in silence and we meditate. So people begin to engage in their visualization practice, very creative bardo. And all that leads up to the public ordinations, which is a great day of celebration. And then we continue even longer in silence and meditation. And gradually we emerge into more talking and discussion to what we call in a prosaic way the order induction, but really is an initiation into the myth of the order, into the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, again set in a ritual setting of sutra recitation. So a retreat set up in this way, even though it's only 6 weeks at the moment, it allows a deeper contact with the imaginal to unfold under the blue sky. In the sense there's nothing else to do. All concerns have faded away. We're away from the familiar. We've gone forth, but no contact with the outside world, except perhaps that we look down on the village of Batignano and wonder what goes on down there. There's nothing to do but listen to the Dharma, reflect, go deeply within, let go of one's old self, and let the new self blossom and emerge. So in the symbolism of Amitabha, we contemplate the setting sun and turn within, into our own depths and into silent contemplation, going forth ever more deeply, leaving behind old identities and allowing the lotus of our new self to unfold. So within this ritual in mythic space, we enter a timeless realm in which the ordination ceremonies, both private and public, are set like jewels. Now, of course, wherever and however you were ordained, the effect on one's life is enormous. Not everyone can go to your convento. And women, especially women with children, will continue to be ordained outside of that venue, maybe at Tiruvannalokam or elsewhere. And the sort of world I'm describing or trying to evoke by talking about the Pure Land and our attempts to create that ideal convento might cause an amusing contrast with some of your own ordination experiences. For there are some old and well-known stories about how some of you here were ordained. So there's Anoma, for example, who was ordained over a weekend retreat at Broomhouse Farm. So her private ordination was conducted by Bhante on Saturday night, and the public ordination on the following Sunday morning. And then Anoma was put on the work rota immediately after that to clean the oven. And Bhante came into the room and said, "Down to earth with a bump." So Samatar and Sobhana were ordained, I think, privately and publicly on the same day and went straight into Women's Order Convention, which is not so bad, really. But the half-hour order induction that they had by me before that, I think it went in one ear and out the other, really. I don't know so much about Sobhana, but I know that with Samatar, we waited for her for 2 weeks to come to a chapter meeting thinking, "Where is Samatar?" But it really hadn't, you know, gone in that 7 o'clock Sunday night was chapter night. So I was ordained with Marichi at Abhirati, the old rectory in Norfolk, on a large mixed retreat. And at that time, we didn't have silence overnight, or even silence, I think, during the retreat. So after my private ordination, I was making a cup of tea in the kitchen. Someone just wandered in and said, "Oh, hello, what's your name?" You know, so I said, "Well, I'm Starmer, didn't I?" So it's kind of very different from what we've built up, you know, since those days. Well, we've all survived. I think we've more than survived, and we're here to tell the tale. So obviously, in a way, those experiences didn't diminish for us the significance of the step we've taken, because the ordination ceremony itself is a timeless realm, which you enter that magic realm with your private preceptor, and that is what you remember, really. You don't, well, I suppose you do remember if you were asked to clean the oven. I think Enoma remembers that, but nevertheless, you know, at depth, at heart, you remember the actual ordination ceremony. But I'm sure you'll agree that one could set that step, that timeless moment, within a more ritual and mythic context, which would make it more explicit its significance for you. It would allow that significance to unfold for you. In a sense, the context is secondary to the event itself, but the context provides, as it were, a container, or a crucible, if you like, or the alembic vessel of alchemy, a sealed vessel in which an experience can be distilled and intensified, and it's not opened until the base metal within that vessel is being totally transformed. So I was recently trying to describe the difference between an ordination retreat at Il Convento to being ordained on a two-week TFR retreat at Tirunelveli to someone who has that choice, who could make that choice. And I was saying, well, I thought if she had the choice, she could make that choice, it'd be better if she chose Il Convento. So, of course, if people get ordained on a two-week retreat at Tirunelveli, of course, we work to surround that experience with meaning and beauty on the retreat. People do have the chance to take up the sixth element practice and practice that every day. They meet up with their private preceptor during the retreat. The private ordination hut or kuti is prepared with great care, and the ordinations do take place in silence. And the public ordination is also prepared for with great care and has the advantage of being able to be more open to friends and guests. However, an ordination retreat at Il Convento is different and it's longer, so therefore there's much more time to prepare for the ordinations and to absorb the impact, as I've said. And there's nothing else going on. I think that's the main difference, perhaps, that the retreat is totally focused on ordination. Everyone there is either getting ordained or is ordaining someone or is there on the support team to help create the best possible conditions for the retreat and for that to happen. So although a Going for Refuge retreat at Tirunelveli is a very positive event, yes, there's just not much time. There's not much time between the private and public ordination. There's no time to absorb the impact afterwards, or very little time. And there's no time to just live in that situation as an order member, to engage with the myth of the order in that kind of way. So although I think our previous ordination retreats have all been very special, obviously, and very special for everyone on them, whether at Rivendell, Tara-loka, Tiratna-loka, Dharna-kosha, or wherever, in America, New Zealand. I think Tuscany has been a bit more special. First of all, because it's not in the United Kingdom, so majority of women getting ordained still come from the United Kingdom. And though it is still relatively short, it's still only 6 weeks, 6 weeks, 2 days, I think, it is the longest ordination retreat for women so far. So I think it not being in this country does enhance that whole going forth dimension of going for refuge. So people do leave behind the known, as it were. They leave behind their friends, their native country, their work, even if it's team-based right now, their community, their lovers, and just go off, as it were, into the unknown. So making that journey to Il Convento that Bhante so wonderfully describes in that work. And in doing so, we begin to evoke and live out the myth of the journey. And ordination in itself is a mythic journey, so you're making that much more explicit. I did suggest last year to people that they saw that going forth as beginning from the moment they left wherever they live, in whichever country actually, so that they didn't have a little holiday in Italy with their boyfriend, girlfriend, and leave them at the gates of Il Convento, that they actually sort of did try to extend the feeling of going forth, and the same after the retreat, that they didn't immediately meet up with boyfriend, girlfriend, but they travelled alone or with someone they were going to be on retreat. But I think most people took that suggestion. So just, you know, it gives it a little bit longer than the actual 6 weeks. And again, it's a sort of ritual, mythic approach. So once there, as I said, in some way we seal the mandala of practice, and then we're out of contact for those weeks. So retreatants, and most of the team at the moment, come for the whole time we're there, so we create a world between us. And we are in an unfamiliar situation, unless you've actually lived in Tuscany at some point in your life. It's very beautiful, the Tuscan hills and valleys, but it's different, the vegetation is different. You know, we sit out in an olive grove, which one doesn't do in this country. The animal, birds, insect and reptilian life are different. Even the sheep look very different. They're not like Welsh sheep, the Italian sheep. The light is different. The colour of the stone of the building is different. We do look down on this village of Batignano, but it looks nothing like an English or Welsh village. The weather is different. So we're away from the familiar, and in that ritual space we can then begin to build a mandala of practice and ritual and myth which supports our preparation for the jewel of ordination, which is set right at the heart of that mandala. So one of the things we have is a little bit more time than we've had in the past. So we've got time to settle in, time to create the conditions, we've got time to reflect on our ethical lives, time to enter the realm of spiritual death through the six element practice, time to meet up with our preceptor and others in our kula, got time to open ourselves to the mythic dimension and meet a Buddha or Bodhisattva, have time to just contemplate, just sit and think, write, paint, time to set the private and public ordinations in a context of silence and intensive practice. And then we have time to gradually re-emerge from that silence into words and discussion. I think Il Convento does lend itself to this kind of retreat, an old and crumbling building. The cloisters are very appropriate for ritual practice and circumambulation. It's reasonably rustic. Some of the rooms are without electricity. So we can have a simple life. We can eat outside every day. We can sit in the olive grove. So it's a very simple situation, very apt for having an ordination retreat. So I think that the journey to Il Convento has been a good one for the women's wing to take. I think it's already had an effect on those who've been on those retreats, whether as new order members or on the team. I think there are limits and drawbacks to Il Convento. One limit, of course, is time. We could extend that retreat by 1 or 2 weeks, and we may do that next year. But it's still a relatively short stretch of time in which to set such a crucial experience, the experience of ordination. Another limit is the fact that to set up from scratch somewhere each year is an enormous amount of work for the organisers. We can build on our previous experience, but in a way it's limited how much we can build on that experience. So I think we do need to continue to dream our dream of a Pure Land, of our own ordination retreat centre, somewhere, again, outside of the United Kingdom, hopefully in Europe somewhere. Somewhere, yes, not too hard of access. I think Vajradevi said not too far from an airport, but more remote than Il Convento. Some people quite like looking down on the village of Batignano, but actually I found it a distraction. People sometimes sit outside the gates and wander into the property. So I think it would be great to have somewhere that was much more remote. So I think we'd need somewhere with enough land so that we were not impinged on by others and would not be impinged on by others in the future, so that we can feel away from the world. I mean, this is one of the things that's happened at Gihaloka. They didn't have the money when they bought Gihaloka to buy enough land, really. And so, you know, people have bought land nearby and buildings and so on. So they're much more kind of impinged on than they would like, I'm sure. So if we can find somewhere where, you know, we've got enough land, so the retreat centre is set in the heart of that land, we could feel far away. So we need somewhere where over the years we can build what we need, whether that's in terms of accommodation, shrine rooms, ordination kutis, solitary retreat huts, maybe a vihara, who knows, we just have to dream at the moment. And we can develop our relationship with that place, with that land, in a ritual way. Ideally it would be somewhere with a resident community, living a simple life, so that practice is continuing all year round in that situation. So the ordination retreat, as it were, comes in to that realm of practice rather than, you know, you start from scratch, as it were. And somewhere where we could be, hopefully, for 3 to 4 months a year on an ordination retreat. I mean, maybe at some point in the future we will, like the men, have 2 ordination retreats a year, or 4 months' length, looking into the future, but where we can set that jewel of ordination, the ordination ceremony, ever more deeply into a setting of myth and ritual, meditation and silence. So we can imagine or think about what effect our own retreat centre might have on us and the women's wing and the whole order. I think one of the things that would happen if we had our own place and a longer ordination retreat is that each phase of the retreat, which is now really in sort of embryonic form, would just be able to expand. So the whole letting go of our old self and our old life would be much more radical if we were away for 4 months. The setting of the ritual context, the sealing of the mandala, could take weeks rather than a couple of days. And that could be a whole kind of process of ritual. Our reflection on the precepts could have more time. I think we could go much deeper and engage much more deeply with the practice of confession. And I think this would change the culture, as it were, within the women's wing of the order. I think from my own experience on retreats and post-ordination retreats and talking to order members in chapters, that people are sometimes still a little uncertain about the practice of confession because it needs a lot of trust. It is a practice. You have to sort of take a risk to confess, but it needs an atmosphere of trust. You need to build up to it. And I think if a number of people were in community reflecting on the precepts and practicing confession over a period of 4 months, they would take that back, bring that back, I think, into the body of the women's wing of the order, back into their chapters. And I think that would have a very good effect on our spiritual lives. It would kind of intensify our ethical practice. And given that immediate or quick confession is one of the marks of a stream entrant, it would take us further, I think, along the path to stream entry. So the six element practice, at the moment, it's taught over about 6 days, really, and then we do engage with it after that. But I think if we had much more time, we could engage in that practice much more deeply. It's a very, very beautiful practice, and it's a very strong practice. So the whole phase of spiritual death could be opened up over several weeks and give us a much deeper basis for spiritual rebirth. And again, and the men's ordination retreats of 4 months, I think they engage in the six element, well, they engage in the six element practice, I think perhaps all the way through, or at least half the way through. And so they go much more deeply into that insight practice, letting go of their old self. And there's been some wonderful series of talks done in that context by Subhuti and by Chittapala, where they've been able to just explore the implications of that practice. So there's quite a lot of talk in the order at the moment about meditation, intensity of practice and the development of insight, which is very good. And I think having a number of people in this particular context of a long ordination retreat, the beginning of one's order life, as it were, having several months of both samatha and vipassana practice would have an enormous effect on our individual and collective practice. More time would give us more time to develop that crucial relationship with our private preceptor. In a way, it's the essential, crucial relationship. It's the person who witnesses our entry, our going for refuge, our effective going for refuge. Our relationship with the public preceptor is not quite so intimate. So it's a very, very important relationship, and I think it would be good to have more time with one's private preceptor on an ordination retreat. So if we had more time, we'd also have more time for our connection with the imaginal to emerge. So it would just emerge from the clear blue sky without any pressure whatsoever. So again, it's something that people kind of worry about, which Buddha or Bodhisattva, even in a slightly longer 6-week retreat, still, you haven't got that long before the private ordination, and you're supposed to, you are going to have a connection with the imaginal at your private ordination ceremony. So there's still a little bit of pressure to sort of, which Buddha or Bodhisattva is it going to be? And I think that would kind of go if one had greater time and more space and more silence and more six-element practice. It would just emerge, really. So there'd be more time to absorb the impacts of the ordinations, more time to engage in the practice of visualization. I mean, the whole principle of the new sadhanas is that they unfold slowly. But in a way, I don't think we can follow that through while we're still only on a 6-week ordination retreat. We tend to have a couple of weeks where we do visualization, but people need to go away knowing what the whole practice is and so on. I think if we had just much longer, well, we could just sit and contemplate the blue sky for as long as it took, and then allow that the lotus to emerge in that blue sky and take the practice as it's meant to be, just very, very slowly, each stage resonating with us. And we'd have more time to live together as an ordered community. Maybe the second half of the retreat we'd be living as an ordered community, exploring the myth of the order, allowing Amitabha's infinite rays of light and love to be transformed into the thousand arms of Avalokiteshvara. Perhaps we'd have time to do some Dharma study. We don't have time to do that on a six-week retreat. We've made a choice, really, whether to recite sutras or study, and we've opted the last 2 years for a sutra recitation. But we could actually really engage in in-depth Dharma study. So there's so many things that we could do if we had more time, and I think we could only really have that kind of length of ordination retreat with our own place at the moment. So we would live in a timeless realm where anything could happen. In a way, it's quite difficult to describe in words, you know, the possibility, and we just have to try and engage imaginatively. But I was reading last month's Shabda recently, and the first several reportings in are by men ordained quite recently at Guhaloka. So what they said about that experience struck me, and I've got a few quotes here because they've lived through a four-month ordination retreat. So one of them said, "At Guhaloka it seemed that the key to my spiritual life was the imagination. Everything seemed to coalesce and point towards the imaginal as the core of my practice." So it just gives you a flavour, and of course Bhante is stressed, doesn't he, over and over and over and over again, the importance of the imagination, of the imaginal state of mind or consciousness beyond reason and emotion, a state of deep faith. And someone else says, "By the time we were due to leave, I had started to feel that I had been in Guhaloka all my life." So again, that sort of timeless sense, so it's long enough to forget the beginning, as it were, and not be thinking about the end. Someone else says, "The more I think about the course, the more I have the sense that what happened didn't happen in Spain, in the Spanish mountains, at Guhaloka. It seems to have happened in a mythical world, seemingly out of space and out of time. It happened in our minds. We between us created a world and inhabited it together. A purer, simpler world, closer to nature and its spirits. A less cluttered world where things had more fluidity and possibilities seemed boundless and unlimited." So I think that just sort of expresses some of the possibilities. So I think all this will become more possible for us when we have an ordination retreat centre of our own, where we can let go and explore the myth of ordination in whatever way seems appropriate to us. Of course, this retreat centre will not only benefit the new order members of the future, but it should be possible for order members ordained elsewhere to come on those retreats and have that experience also. So hopefully it will be a place of beauty, a place where practice, faith and devotion to the three jewels will blossom and flourish, a timeless realm of withdrawal into that inner world of subtle spiritual perception and transcendental vision, of myth and ritual, where we can leave our old selves behind and allow the new to blossom, and we can relate to one another on that basis, a pure land created by all of us. So I would ask you to envision with me and Vajradevi such a place, a pure land devoted to the practice of the Dharma, a simple place where all worldly concerns can fade away, a place of intensive practice, beauty, myth and ritual. A crucible for the creation of future women order members and the order of the future.